I'm Jesse Thorne. This is The Turnaround. The show where I ask interviewers about interviewing. It's a partnership between Maximum Fun and the Columbia Journalism Review. My guest this week is the writer Susan Orlean. She's been a journalist for over 30 years. She's written for everything from Rolling Stone to Vogue. And for the last 25 years or so, she's been a staff writer at The New Yorker. She's also the author of several best-selling books, one of them, The Orchid Thief, you might have seen as the movie adaptation. Here is Susan Orlean's superpower, and this is absolutely real. She can walk into any situation. She could walk into a town she'd never been to in Wyoming. She could walk into a party at Gay Talese's house. She could walk into the palace of a, you know, Central European dictator. And she walks out with a story because she is the kind of person who is always ears open, who is always poking and prodding and pulling everyone around her until she sees that little glint of gold in her panning for gold pan, that little something magical. And then she works it a little more and works it a little more. And all of a sudden, she's got a best-selling book.
Much of the time, it's I have a little bit of a notion. I'm kind of curious about it. My editor says, well, if you think it's a good idea, give it a shot. And suddenly I'm, wow, what was it that got me here? I got to figure that out. And let me start flailing about and see if someone I can hook onto something that begins to make it make sense and leads to something else. As a result, I would say most of the stories that I do end up not being at all what I thought they were going to be.
All right. I'm not going to hold it back anymore. Let's get into it. Susan Orlean on The Turnaround. Well, Susan Orlean, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming in and doing this.
It's my pleasure. I'm happy to be here talking about talking.
Well, I feel like all of my experience about with interviewing is in broadcast. I've never done print journalism. Unless you count, I'm not trying to brag, but I had a comic memoir piece that was a cover story in the Metro Santa Cruz once.
Well, there you go. You have credentials.
But sincerely, I have never done any actual print journalism, and the vast majority of what you've done is big feature, real print journalism.
Right, right.
When you go out, like, let's say you're writing a piece for a magazine, piece for The New Yorker, where you're a staff writer, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you go out interviewing people with the idea that you are going to get a particular thing out of each person? Like, oh, I need this piece of my story from this person. Or do you go out first and sort of see what the fishermen bring?
The answer is yes to both, but in a very particular order. To begin with, I'm throwing the net wide, and I happen to believe deeply that it's a big mistake to have a punch list of what you're trying to achieve, particularly in the beginning of a story where presumably you're entering it in part to learn. And if you begin by simply having a list of questions that you're checking off, I don't think you're really learning, certainly not in the context of the kind of stories I write. Later on, there will be the need to grab certain people for certain parts of the story to respond to a question you have or to perhaps balance out something that you got earlier in the story. But to me, that's such a different part of the process. So in the beginning, I will very intentionally go into each interview as open as I can. I'll interview people who seem very tangential to the story because the whole process for me is something has stuck in my head that I want to understand. And to me, the only way to truly understand it is to be really open and cast myself in every possible direction rather than having a thesis that I'm looking to support.
Give me an example of a piece that you wrote and where the first who the first person was that you went to talk.
Let me think of a good example of this, you know, because I've done a lot of profiles, which are a whole other matter because it's so specific.
No, you just go to Wikipedia.com and
right,
go
exactly.
from there. Tick, tap, tap, yeah.
Yeah, and then search them on truthfinder.com and you're done.
Add a couple dollar words, search for their name plus net worth,
yeah,
and you're good to go.
Well, I'll give you an example, probably an extreme example, because the story itself was so diffuse in its purpose. And this was many years ago in the wake of the Tonya Harding scandal. If those of you listening recall, Tonya Harding, disgraced figure skater who had been known to orchestrate an attack on Nancy Kerrigan, her greatest Olympic rival. And then she went completely underground. You know, it was a crazy, crazy scenario. And people were desperately trying to think of a story to write about it, particularly because she wasn't talking to the press at that point. And I had the idea that it would be interesting to look at where she was from. She was from Clackamas, Oregon, which is not exactly a suburb of Portland, but a sort of exurb. Having lived in Portland, I knew that some of the news reports said Tonya Harding is from Portland, Oregon. And I thought, well, first of all, she's not. And secondly, there's a huge difference between being from Portland, which is one very particular kind of place, and Clackamas, which is essentially a rural, white, conservative town that had, in a sense, no connection to the Portland, Oregon that we know. The
right.
Groovy...
I mean, this was like Spotted Owl times, right?
Yeah.
When like the entire Northwest was consumed by this liberal city versus conservative rural battle over environmentalism and logging. And and you know, 25 years ago, Portland wasn't even the Portland that we think of now.
Right.
I mean, it was changing.
But it was on its way, but you're right. It wasn't the Portland we know now, but it was still distinctly different from Clackamas. So for one thing, having read in these news reports this quickie shorthand of saying that Tonya Harding was from Portland, and I thought, no, no, no. And it's not only an error in fact, it's an error in concept. So I just basically proposed to The New Yorker to go to Clackamas and spend time roaming around and trying to cobble together some sense of Tonya Harding through the lens of the town she grew up in, which I happen to feel strongly gave you a better idea of who she was, because she really was an outlier in the world of figure skating. She wasn't this pretty little princess. She was a kind of rough and tough girl from a trailer park, essentially. I flew to Portland and drove to Clackamas. And having lived in Portland for 4 years, I can also tell you that I had spent very little time in Clackamas. And simply...
They're a great farmer's market.
Right. And there are a lot of things that were interesting, but I simply wandered and talked to anyone and everyone that I could find. Some of it was to talk to them about Tonya. Some of it was just to talk to them about Clackamas. And I went to, I talked to a real estate broker. I went to a thrift shop because I thought, well, I wonder what people in Clackamas give to the thrift shop. I didn't have an agenda. And to be honest with you, it's a tough kind of story to do. But I really felt that I could only do it if I didn't have an agenda except to say, I have some sense of what this place is. I have some sense that it actually tells you more about Tonya. And maybe I need to go into that and basically immerse myself, you know, be an embed in Clackamas. And I actually spent time with the Tonya Harding fan club, which was in something of extremist at that point, feeling fairly defensive and besieged. So that's an example of, I thought, I have no, I don't know where I'm going to find the good material. And I like the fact that I don't know, even though while you're working on a story like that, it can be really scary because you'll be in a thrift shop and then you think, what am I doing in a thrift shop? I'm trying to write a story about an Olympic figure skater. And you have to accept it's I think the best model to compare it to is thinking of traveling. And if you go to Paris and say, I'm here to see the Eiffel Tower, go see it, check it off your list, and leave. I don't think that's what most of us feel. That's not why we travel. And it's the serendipity. It's the unexpected conversation that you have with someone you run into. It's sitting and watching people walk by as you're in a cafe. That's where you begin getting a sense of the experience you're having. And frequently, the big ticket item, the Eiffel Tower, is kind of a letdown. The way the big ticket interview, often those people are not only less interesting than you would like them to be, but they're, if they are the big interview, they're also very prepared and guarded, and they look at you the way you look at them, which is how can I protect myself and only reveal what's comfortable for me? So those are, in my experience, rarely the ones that make you think, aha, I got my story.
I want to get into, like, what it's like to interview somebody for a, you know, personality profile piece, interview a famous person. But first, you had me thinking about a former colleague of mine here at Maximum Fun named Abadianex Perello. And Abadianex actually does a great interview podcast about photography called The Candid Frame. But Abadianex is a street photographer, and he teaches street photography. And he taught a workshop here at Max Fun before he left. And one of the things that's remarkable to me about street photography and that I learned from Abadianex that still scares the crap out of me is there's basically two things you're doing. You know, you think that you are just grabbing things as you're walking around, but to get a great photograph on the street, he's doing two things. One is bothering people.
Right.
And one is standing and he finds something he likes and he stands there for 20 minutes, half an hour, 40 minutes, waiting for something special to happen there. Like he finds a pool of light or whatever. He finds a pattern of colors on the ground, a background he likes, and just stands there.
Wow.
And waits for something to happen for him to photograph. Both of those prospects terrify me. And when you describe going to Clackamas, Oregon, you are basically engaging in those two things. One is going up to somebody that you do not know anything about and whatever, and just being like, hey, do you mind if I bother you? You will get nothing out of it. And then,
yep, you're talking about my life here. This is my life.
So, what do you do? Like, what? How do you talk to the lady behind the counter at the thrift store, or you know, a woman at a diner, or whatever?
First of all, I have to accept that a large part of my work life involves being deeply uncomfortable. It would be wrong to say to you, "Oh, that doesn't bother me." Because I think it's human nature to feel this tremendous awkwardness to walk up to a stranger and say, give me your time, talk to me, and I am offering you nothing in return. It's incredibly uncomfortable. And sometimes I actually wonder what has motivated me to do it. I've certainly gotten better at it over the many years I've been doing it, in the sense that I know the easier ways of starting that conversation as opposed to probably when I was younger and less experienced.
Pro tip time. What are the pro tips? What's the secrets?
Well, the number one thing also is to go into it understanding or holding close to your heart the realization that most people actually enjoy being listened to. So as much as it feels like this embarrassing intrusion and a request to be given something for nothing in return, you are giving something in return. People actually like to be heard. There are plenty of people who won't and who will simply say, go away. But it is impressive to look back at the number of people that I've approached that way and remember how many of them, even the ones who at first were very resistant, rose to the experience of being listened to. And just before I give you my pro tips, I just want to tell you about one experience I had that was actually the funniest, perhaps most perfect example of this.
Which Hold is, on. You want to share a funny story on my podcast?
I'm trying
to do pro tips here.
Right. Well, I will get to the pro tips. Okay. And this includes a pro tip, which Great. Was when I lived in New York, I was driving through Queens one day, and I saw a sign on a store that was called, excuse me, I'm losing my voice a little, the Lemon Ice King of Corona. And I just thought, oh my God, this is so funny, the idea that the sort of grandiosity of this to have a business which was selling lemon ice, which is, you know, basically shaved ice with flavoring, but to have the sort of sense of yourself as being so grand that you're declaring that you are the lemon ice king of a neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it cracked me up, and I thought this would be a fun story to do.
Well, you had never been part of the Corona's legendary lemon ice war of the roses.
Right. Oh, of course. I forgot. Back in the 1880s.
Yeah.
So I came back the next day, and I figured in my arrogant way that, of course, I would walk in and introduce myself and that the Lemon Ice King of Corona would be thrilled to talk to me because, my God, I was going to write a piece about him for The New Yorker. I came and introduced myself. I said, you know, I just want to talk to you about lemon ice and your business and so on and so forth. And the man looked at me. He was a sort of middle-aged guy. Classic, what you would expect of a lemon ice king. And he said to me, he looked sort of sternly at me, he said, sorry, no press. And I said, what? No press? And he said, no press, I'm sorry. And I was utterly flabbergasted. I thought, you're a small business owner. I'm giving you basically free exposure. What are you talking about? So pro tip number one, I didn't walk away. I stood there and I said, but what, I was just one. And I sort of kind of blabbered a bit and, you know, because I honestly was so shocked. And he again said, you know, no press, because people think, and he started talking, and he talked for 45 minutes straight, basically starting with the idea of no press, and everybody wants to know my secrets, and, you know, because in fact he was this rather vain, self-important guy, which is exactly why I was attracted to the idea of writing a story about it. Literally, I had to finally say to him, I'm so sorry, I've got to go. Talked and talked and talked and talked. So pro tip number one, you have to just be willing to be uncomfortable, to probably be rejected initially. And the response doesn't have to be rude, but just remember that if somebody approached you out of the blue and said, will you talk to me about X, your response would be, sorry, I'm busy, or I don't want to talk about it. That's where you have to just hold your ground and give it a minute. Give it a minute. Be there. Argue your case a little, or try to start a conversation that is not related to you wanting to interview the person. Divert. And in this case, you know, and it's not to trick people, but you're a stranger. Why would someone want to talk to you? So after a few minutes of saying, no, I'm not going to talk to you. I'm simply not. No press. You've been there for a little while then. And then you can say, but why no press? Well, you know, because people are always trying to steal my recipes. And let me tell you about the employee I had who went out here and started Lemon Ice prints of Corona. And I'm furious about it. And there you go. So, number, you know, that's probably the most important moment, because I would say the majority of the time, if you're approaching a stranger, you're going to get shut down. It's a actually perfectly natural thing. And you have to hold your position, try to make it over that moment where you are a complete stranger inserting yourself into somebody's personal space, and see if you can get beyond it. I've had few occasions where someone literally said, uh-uh. It's happened, of course. It's happened. But whenever I think about that piece, I remind myself of the journalist's first responsibility is to suffer a little in the beginning. And my philosophical position on that is that it brings you to a level with the person that you're trying to interview. You come in essentially having a lot of power.
Because you're the one telling the story.
I'm the person telling the story. I'm the fancy journalist. I'm, you know, invading your space and having the arrogance to do that. Suddenly the table turns and they're basically saying, no, why should I talk to you? So your power is suddenly undercut. And I think that's a good thing. I think it's a moment where that person, rather than feeling intimidated or off kilter by you approaching them, suddenly is, well, no, I'm in charge. I'll decide if I want to talk to you or not. And that's why I go into interviews generally very unprepared, which might come as a shock, and any journalism teacher listening to this would probably suddenly turn it off and say, oh my God, I don't want my students to hear this. But an authentic meeting requires a certain equality. And if I come in saying, but I've researched Corona and I researched Lemon Ice and I know more than you do. So now just provide me with quotes for my story. Instead of saying, I don't know Corona. I don't know anything in the history. I don't even know what Lemon Ice is. I've never had a Lemon Ice. Suddenly, the Lemon Ice King of Corona, he's restored to his position of a certain kind of comfort and power. And maybe he'll say, oh, well, let me tell you about it.
There's this essential issue, which is that this guy, like any one of us, in interacting with a journalist, and I know it's certainly been my situation when I interact with a journalist as the subject of something, your fear is that someone else is telling your story.
Right.
And what you're describing is a situation where you allow someone to feel, and to some extent to be, telling their own story, in that you are not imposing the story upon them through your research and whatever.
Right.
That's clear. You're asking, what is the story?
And the dynamic that I prefer, rather than I'm the journalist asking you questions, is I'm the person who doesn't know about something you've mastered. Will you teach me? And this is where that sense of pride where a person can think, well, I do know about my story and my life and my subject. And maybe if I feel comfortable with the authenticity of your curiosity, I'll teach you a little. It honestly has been... I did a story many years ago. It's actually my favorite piece, where I traveled with a black gospel group down south for a couple of weeks. Before I went, a lot of people said to me, did you read this definitive history of gospel music? And did you read that? And, you know, and people were telling me about all of these different, you know, important encyclopedic reviews of, you know, gospel, the history of gospel music. And I said, no, I'm going to go live this life with these people for a couple of weeks and they'll teach me. And at the end, if there's still things I need to fill in, I can go look it up. I can go get dates or, you know, more background if they haven't provided it for me. But I felt that it undercut my privilege as the journalist, as a white person, as a person with a job at a fancy magazine, you know, because I often write about people whose socioeconomic position is less privileged than mine. So to me, it's really important to change the balance of power and to say, look, you know your story. I don't. I'm here to ask you about it, and then I'd like to share it with other people.
It seems really important that that curiosity be very sincere. It seems like something that people would sniff out in a second.
Yeah. And I think they absolutely do. I think people sense immediately if you've already made your mind up about who they are and what they're like. Having been on the other side of interviews, I can say that I can usually tell. And I'm discomfited if somebody interviewing me trots out facts about me. Rather than me thinking, oh, good, you did your homework, instead I feel like, ew. you know, it feels unnerving. So, you know, and there's situations where you're given a very short amount of time to talk to someone and you do need to know what you're going to use that time for and be purposeful. But as much as you can replicate that experience with them, which is you have a story. I'm here to hear your story, even if they're a famous person. I think that's where you start getting to a real connection.
Have you ever been in this position of having to talk to someone, having to ask someone something, and felt more than socially uncomfortable? Like been physically scared or?
Actually, thank goodness, no. And I've been with a lot of weird people in my time.
That's our pull quote.
Yeah. And I will say that that's for better or for worse. Because number one, I think while I am working on a story, I have this a false sense of I feel like You feel invulnerable because you are so focused on this work and getting this thing done. And you sometimes are a little oblivious to situations that maybe aren't so safe. And nothing's ever happened to me. But occasionally I will think back and you know, think about where I've been and what I've done and think, whoa, that. I'm not sure if I had a kid doing that, I would be that happy. I think that that explains sometimes when we hear about journalists in war zones, or I look at the Daniel Pearl story as a great example of this. People many times look back on the tragedy of what happened to him and think, why would he ever be willing to meet with a possibly dangerous person, knowing that he was in a place where journalists were imperiled. Because while you're doing it, you have some strange sense of being protected. And I think it's, on one hand, it makes it possible for you to do it. It makes it possible for you to talk to the lady at the cafe and overcome all of that social discomfort. you just extend that a little further and you're walking in a neighborhood at night that you maybe shouldn't be in, or, you know, because you couldn't do it if you weren't able to override some of the fears that we all have, whether they're the petty fear of feeling embarrassed or rejected, or the more concrete fear of someone hurting you.
How is it different to talk to someone who is a public figure with whom you have an agreed amount of time that you are going to, whatever, I guess, in my imagination, print journalists always interview celebrities over brunch at the Four Seasons.
Right. That's a convention in every single celebrity profile.
What's the difference between talking to someone like that, a public figure where it's set up, and talking to the kind of person who you talk to when you, you know, look up someone's phone number in the phone book and call them at their office, or walk into their diner and talk to them at the counter?
Night and day. They could not be more different. First of all, the public figure, the celebrity, has skin in the game. They're getting something out of you. A private person really has no clear takeaway from, except for you saying to them, wouldn't you be happy to see your story told?
People say to me sometimes, like, how come, why, and they usually, because they're nice, reverse the frame and say, like, you know, I feel like on your show, Bullseye, when you're interviewing people, they're not just flogging their latest project like they are on other things. And I'm like, well, number one, yes, they are just flogging their latest project like they are on other things. And number two, of course they're flogging their project. Why else would they agree to come to my office and hang out with a guy they don't know?
Right.
Like, they're getting a benefit from this, as we are.
It's transactional the way it isn't with the private person, because they really don't. I mean, sure, you sell the option to your story and a movie gets made and their life rights are bought, but that wouldn't even occur to most people. So that's not a real fact in this transaction. Number two, the public figure, no matter how much they will lean over and say to you, wink, wink, I'm telling you this special thing because I feel really connected to you, unless they're really dumb and reckless, that isn't happening. They're very careful about what they're telling you. They're strategic, and they've told it to a billion people. My great comeuppance in this regard was many years ago when I worked for Rolling Stone, and this is not in any way meant to put down Tom Hanks, who is a really genuine, authentic guy.
Seriously,
but,
though, Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks can stick his head up his own rear, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, okay. Well, he...
Death to Tom Hanks.
No,
that's
stop.
My motto. Susan Orlean and Jesse Thorne say...
Yeah, no, he... So, I was interviewing him for Rolling Stone, and two different friends of mine who work for other publications, coincidentally, because he had a movie out and he was on a press tour. And I had two other friends who were also doing profiles of him. So it was an opportunity to see this in action. And I met him over breakfast at the Four Seasons, as you said. He's a really, really nice guy and really smart. And we had a great time talking. His answers were not canned, but the fact is that my questions were probably pretty canned. I mean, what are you going to ask an actor? Like, it's all the same
actors.
Nonsense.
Yeah.
So
they barely do anything.
And
mostly just look like the right thing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's like 75% of their job.
Yeah, it's like, I look like that guy. So at one point he said to me, first of all, he said to me, I know we're only supposed to have 45 minutes, but I'm having, you know, I don't mind. Let's stick around longer. So I'm like, whoa, he really likes me. And then he said to me at some point, I'm going to tell you something that I've really never told anyone before. And if I remember correctly, it was that he said, you know, I don't like the way I look, or I don't think I'm good looking, something like that. I thought, oh my God, I completely scored. We've bonded. He's telling me the stuff that is really just because we've made this connection. You probably see where this story is going. In the conversation with both of my other friends who interviewed him, we all sort of bragged to each other. We only had 45 minutes, but he wanted to spend more time because we really hit it off. True for all of us. True for all of us that he said, you know, I've really never told anyone this before, but... Tom Hanks, again, I want to underscore this. This is not to diss him. This is the game. This is the way it's played. And he played it very well. He had all of us feeling like, wow, we really connected. He's very good at that. It was my moment of thinking, this is his interview. He's in total control, and it's to promote his movie and, enlarge his brand. And I'm selling magazines. Rolling Stone will have Tom Hanks on the cover, and that'll sell magazines. It was a kind of a sobering moment for me. It was the first moment when I felt like I understood the symbiosis of fame and media. And it is ever thus. It will always be. This isn't to say that you can never get a good interview with a well-known person, but you sure better go into it realizing that this is not the same experience that you're having going to a person who's not a public figure and saying, tell me your story and tell me who you are and what your life is all about.
It's a turnaround. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Susan Orlean. We'll have more when we come back in just a second.
I'm Hal Lublin.
I'm Danielle Radford.
I am Michael Eagle.
And we are the hosts of Tights and Fights, Maximum Fun's newest podcast dedicated to all things wrestling.
We'll be talking about Sasha Banks, the women's revolution, Sasha Banks, the brand split, and Sasha Banks' wigs.
And we'll also be talking about wrestler fashion. Some wrestlers wear too many clothes. Some wrestlers don't wear enough clothes at all.
And I'll be doing impressions of all your favorite wrestlers.
New episodes Thursdays on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts. Oh, yeah, dig it.
Tights and Fights Podcast. Tights and Fights.
Hey, Max Fun community. This is your friend Elizabeth Gilbert, author of Eat, Pray, Love, and a bunch of other stuff. I am a longtime member, supporter, and devoted follower of Maximum Fun. And now finally I have my own podcast on the network. It's called Magic Lessons, and it is me coaching people through their creative issues and problems. This season we have some amazing creators that we're helping through their joys and struggles of making something out of nothing. And then I bring in special guests like Glennon Doyle Melton, Brandon Stanton, Martha Beck, the poet Mark Nepo, Michael Ian Black, Sarah Jones, Gary Sheingart, these amazing friends of mine to come and help coach these people so that they can get their work done. I hope you'll tune into it. It's called Magic Lessons, and it's all about love.
Welcome back to The Turnaround. I'm talking to the writer and actually sometime podcaster, Susan Orlean. Do you feel nervous about interviewing public figures ever?
Oh, yeah, I do. Because usually there's a limited amount of time. Usually you know they've been asked these questions a million times. So you feel, to begin with, just unoriginal and kind of dumb because you know you're going to say something they've heard a million times before. And they're always, I mean, I've never interviewed a public figure who wasn't pleasant and engaging and
Really?
I shouldn't say that. Let me correct that. I have. Now that I'm thinking about it, I definitely have. But my level of nervousness has nothing to do with their behavior. It's more with feeling like trying to think, can I think of an original question? Although, frankly, it doesn't even matter. It really doesn't. If you came up with an incredibly original question, chances are they would deflect and get back to the answers that they're more comfortable giving anyway.
I get nervous when I am interviewing. I don't generally feel nervous about it anymore. I think at some point I decided, like, at this point, I mean, I've been doing what I do for 15 years, and probably 5 or 7 years ago, I decided, that's just a guy or a lady.
Right.
You know, like, what, you know, nothing's going to happen bad.
Yeah.
But the time that I do get nervous is when I am worried that I am going to mess it up for the audience. And especially like a time recently that I got nervous was when I interviewed Elvis Costello, and it ended up going great. It was a great interview. You should definitely go back and listen to it if you're listening to this. But I was worried about Elvis Costello mostly because I was thinking of like my co-host on my comedy show, Jordan. Elvis Costello is everything to him. You know, mm-hmm. He went to the Elvis Costello show. He's got every Elvis Costello album. And I know that there's a world of people for whom that is true.
Right.
And I also know that I'm not one of those people. So and it's not because I don't like I don't dislike Elvis Costello or anything. I like Elvis Costello, but it's not my heart, you know. And I worry that I will end up doing something like how I feel when I read New Yorker article not by Calafisana about hip hop.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? Like I'll get that feeling like they don't get it.
Yeah. And I also, yes, number one, I think it's hard to interview someone who you're deeply invested in, partly because you feel that you've got all the personal emotions around it. It's a lot easier to interview someone that you don't feel particularly connected to. And actually, when I was at Rolling Stone, because I love music so much, I started preferring writing about musicians who I did not like, whose music I didn't like, because it was a lot. I thought I did a better job. But there's a very important difference between what you do and what I do, which is what you do takes place in the moment. For me, there's a whole other and in some cases more important iteration of the interview, which is when I process it as part of the writing. So sounding kind of less than brilliant it is okay for me because that doesn't have to ever show on the page. It's different. You know, I do a podcast. I interview people. And on one hand, it's sort of fabulous because I feel like at the end of the interview, I'm done. But also at the moment, it's like flying an airplane. You know, it's now or never. You do it right or it's a disaster. It's very different when you're interviewing people for a written piece. 90% of the interview ends up on the floor anyway. All of your awkward questions and flubs are excised. You're finding the great material, and the rest shall never be seen.
I think it makes a big difference to do an interview where you are looking for golden moments and you are just and you know that you can, if you can figure out what the story is, you can be responsible for telling the story if you have these moments, relative to the kind of thing where it has to be consistent and happen throughout. I mean, I think in my job of I'll occasionally do one of the interviews for a segment on Bullseye called The Song That Changed My Life, which is we interview a musician about a song that was really important to them and why it was important to them. And I know when I'm doing that interview, I sit down with them for half an hour or whatever. I know that what I need out of that interview is a few moments of real feeling.
Uh-huh.
And a little bit of filler.
Right.
And so if I don't get the moment of real feeling that I need and it seems dumb, I know, always know, well, that will be on the cutting room floor.
Right.
I can just ask the same question in a different way, or
right.
I can ask for a different thing that might make a feeling. I can just kind of rummage around in there and see what touches a nerve, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's also another huge piece of this that makes this difference between being a writer and a broadcaster, which is I am the storyteller. I think in broadcast, your subject is the storyteller, and it's your job to help just sort of gently guide them to doing a good job telling the audience their story. For me as a writer, and, you know, certainly in the particular way that I write, I am the storyteller, and it is much more, the better equivalent is to say, let me tell you about this amazing trip I had. If you look at my stories, people always say to me, you always have so many great quotes. And I think, well, you'd be surprised. Go back and look at my stories.
Well, you'd be surprised. I made them up.
Yeah. First of all, they're all fake. In terms of actual quantity of quotes, I don't use that many. What I want is for you to feel that you were there with the people I'm writing about in the place that I'm writing about. But quotes are often not that useful for that. So the actual number of quotes I use is much less than you think. What it's doing, these interviews, their chief purpose is to teach me about someone's story, because then I'm ultimately the narrator telling it and guiding you so that you, the reader, have this feeling that you've gone on that same journey. So there, it is such a different, you know, if you were interviewing someone for broadcast, you're not going to say to them, you know, what year were you born? I mean, there's just so much information that I'm gathering that's just going to be, that I'm going to digest and process in my own voice. As opposed to delivering it in a quote.
I think sometimes of my friend Dave Holmes, who was on television for years and years. I mean, he hosted every television show ever. From was on TRL on MTV through a thousand other television things. And he's now a print journalist. Now writes for GQ, Esquire, for Esquire. But Dave guest hosted Bullseye, my radio show, and I realized, when he does the interview, he has the instincts of a television interviewer, and especially a live television interviewer, where his goal is essentially on television, and, you know, these instincts were informing his radio interview, to protect that guest for 5 minutes, like to get something that he knew would be good for that 5 minutes till the segment's over. You know, just like you go see somebody on the Today Show, there's no surprises happening on the Today Show.
Right.
They've got 5 minutes and they're going to make sure they get these three things in. And there's like a 27-year-old lady with a clipboard backstage who's like, we're talking about this, this, and this.
Right.
This,
right.
This, and this.
Right. You know? Oh, exactly.
And it's like, it's totally.
That's why it's kind of funny for me to call that an interview. I don't think those are interviews.
Well, they're like, it's like facilitating a performance.
Yeah.
Which is its own skill. I mean, I hosted a TV show where I had to do that. And I realized after going in with great confidence, because I was like, yeah, I've been interviewing people for years. And they're like, yeah, we picked you because you're such a brilliant interviewer. And I was like, oh, I have no idea how to do this.
Oh, my God. I would find it incredibly uncomfortable. And, you know, I spend huge amounts of time with people. So for me, that's the other thing. I mean, part of what I do is to spend a lot of time with people where I am not interviewing them. I mean, I find it very difficult to do a story if I don't have a lot of time where I just was hanging out with someone and doing errands with them, observing them as they're going about their business, much less the Q&A part of it. So in a setting like a television interview where you have 3 minutes, I wouldn't even know where to begin. I mean, seriously, I would find it completely awkward and not, I don't feel my skills actually translate to that. I mean, could I be trained? I suppose so, but I don't think that they actually are there's no equivalency really between, you know, when I was writing about this gospel group, I was traveling around with them. I would, when they had errands to do, I'd go do errands with them. I'd hang out. 90% of what we were talking about had nothing to do with the subject of the story. It was like making friends. It was the difference between an organic friendship versus speed dating and getting to know someone in a natural way, as opposed to what's that dating program? It's Just Lunch, where you're like 30 minutes in, out, you like each other, not, boom, done. And you think, I don't know, I wouldn't even know where to begin. Or actually, more correctly, those speed dating programs where you sit and you have 3 minutes and then you move to the next person. I don't know that my intellectual metabolism is at that speed. I'm much more of the 3 days in, we've been hanging out, I'm beginning to figure out who you are.
I want to ask you a magazine-specific question. What do you say to somebody when you have gone and taken a bunch of their time, either hanging out with them, following them around on errands, interviewing them more formally, whatever, and nothing comes of it because you don't sell your pitch or because your story gets spiked or because any of these things that happen in magazine journalism?
Well, knock on wood. Well, let me back that up. I really never write a story on spec. I just don't. And I've occasionally chatted with people with the, you know, exploring the idea if I'm going to pursue it. But I would never launch into a piece in a full way if I didn't know that the magazine wanted it or that it wasn't already assigned. If a story falls by the wayside, which that's where my wood knocking was going to come in, because I'm you know, fortunately that hasn't happened to me very often. It's tough because you've used someone's time. And sometimes people get very angry. There was one story where I didn't even speak to this guy that much, but for a variety of reasons, I mean, he was very excited, and then my schedule changed, and it was just not going to be possible for me to talk to him, and he was really angry. I mean, I felt like he was, I think more than that, he was just deeply disappointed. And all you can do is hope that you were as gracious as you could be during the interview and understand that the disappointment that must feel like. You know, the fact is the person might hate you forever and there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, there really isn't, except to say, you know, with this guy, I just apologized profusely, and I then just had to except the fact that he was probably really angry and felt that I had misled him or that I somehow was in the wrong and there's just nothing I can do about it.
I did an interview one time with a then public radio colleague who no longer works in public radio but worked on a big public radio show. And it was only like an hour maybe. And it was about menswear. I have a menswear blog. And I was like, great, this is going to be a really big impact for the menswear blog. You know, this is going to be really nice. And just never heard anything about it ever again. And yeah, I'm totally still mad at that guy.
Yeah. Listen, I did this also
recently. It was Tom
recently.
Hanks, by the way.
Oh, yeah, really. He's our demon. I had this experience this summer where I was on short notice asked if I would be on a podcast. And it was a little bit of aggravation, which I won't bore you with, just involving the producer who was coming to tape it and so forth. Anyway, did the interview for an hour. I thought it was great. They said, you know, we have to do it today. It's going to be released Wednesday. Tuesday, end of the day, I just had that sick feeling where I thought, this is weird. I haven't heard back from them. And they said, we're going to do it. We're going to release it next week instead. And I thought, And then finally I got this very, you know, I feel like it was almost a tearful email from the producer saying, it wasn't you. You were amazing. It was just, maybe we still don't know what the podcast is actually about. And I was so upset. I was so offended. I was furious. I thought I've wasted my time. And I was really hurt. I was embarrassed because I thought, oh, yeah, they're saying it wasn't me. But obviously, I was awful. I still don't know why, but apparently they just didn't think that the episode sounded good. The value of it was just being reminded how vulnerable people make themselves to us when we say, can we enter your life and take a little bit of it? And the trade-off for you is you're going to have a little thrill in having your story told to the world. And then when that doesn't happen, all that vulnerability is made pretty raw. And it sure was for me. And you would think, man, I'm used to this. I've done this a lot. I was very upset. I was, frankly, you know, in really all day just in the dumps and I hate them and I'm going to get revenge. And then it was, you know, I bargained. I went through all of the stages of grief. It's a good reminder. And it made me think I'll always try to accommodate that a little when I interview people because I know how much it hurts.
I want to ask you some nuts and bolts questions about how you do interviews. And you can tell me if they're different in the different kinds of interviews that you do. When you're doing interviews, do you prepare questions in advance?
I don't. I never do. Probably the only time I've ever done it is interviewing a well-known person with a set amount of time. And I want to, I don't necessarily think I'll stick to the script exclusively, but I feel like I need to have it in case I get flustered or, you know, if there are certain things I really need to ask. Otherwise, no, I don't.
What if it's like an important public figure, like if you were interviewing Colin Powell or something? I know that you're more likely to be interviewing Tom Hanks than that.
Right. No,
that's the scenario where I feel like I would be like so scared if I didn't have written down exact number of the national debt.
Yeah, I don't know. I interviewed Hillary Clinton for Vogue and I was told that I had a half hour. This was some years ago. And I did prepare. I didn't like do a bunch of homework and that kind of preparation, but I thought, all right, what are some of the questions that I can ask her that haven't been asked a million times? And will I be tongue-tied and nervous, in which case I need to make sure that I've got these things in hand? I'm not saying that not preparing is the right way for everybody. I think it depends. It's so dependent on who and what the situation is. I think if you're going to interview someone who is rarely interviewed, who is rarely in the media, I would advise against preparing questions because I think it exaggerates the divide between you as the journalist with power and this person who's not part of this world. And I really urge that. It also means you're forced to listen more. And I've been interviewed by people who ask me the question and then basically don't listen to me because they're just getting ready to ask me the next one. And it's the worst kind of interview that they're just going through their list. They're literally not listening to me. It's very uncomfortable. And you're not getting a good, that's not an interview. It's a checklist.
Do you interview people with a reporter's notebook in hand or a tape recorder or what?
I use a reporter's notebook. I'm a great believer in the value of handwriting. I subscribe to the theory, and I'm happy to say there is science backing me up now, that writing things by hand embeds it in your head in a far deeper way than using a tape recorder or even than typing. It's not easy. If you're trying to get long, long, long quotes, it's pretty difficult.
Do you write in longhand or?
I write kind of a shorthand. And there are a lot of times where I look back on my notes and think, ugh, I wish I understood what I meant when I made that squiggle. So it's not foolproof. I think the number one thing for a writer to do is to listen. Facts can always be checked later. Listening is so much more important than anything else that the obsession with a perfect notebook of notes, to me, is missing the point. But recently, I decided when I started working on my current book, I thought, I wonder if there is some happy medium here. And I got a pen. I now use a different brand, but this one, the one I started with, is called LiveScribe. And they're these very space-age pens that have a tiny camera in the tip of the pen that's recording the pen strokes. It also has a tiny micro recorder in the pen itself. So I take notes by hand, but a recorder is running. So if I ever have to go back and think, ugh, I don't actually understand what I wrote, I have the tape. But I'm not counting on the tape, and chances are I'll never listen to it. But as the additional value of the handwritten notes are uploaded essentially as a photograph to usually you use Evernote. So the value of it to me was that I'm still writing by hand, but I have these two backup, the tape if I feel I need it, and if there's anything where there's a legal issue, I've got it on tape. And secondly, the uploading of the physical notes, because reporters' notebooks are easily destroyed. The dog can eat it. You can spill a cup of coffee on it. I noticed the other day that the ink was fading on some of the notes that I had taken like a year or two ago for the book I'm working on. But I have them uploaded. So it's interesting. I use LiveScribe, then I switch to something called a NeoPen. I think it's a NeoPen. Same idea. And they're kind of cool.
I use a Neo Geo, but only to play the video game Bonk's Adventure.
Oh, okay. Well, if you're a gadget person, which I am, every now and again I would look at my reporter's notebook and pen and feel this letdown of like, I want to have that kind of job where you get a bunch of cool equipment. Although the reality is, thank God that my biggest expense is to buy these $2 reporter's notebooks and, you know, find a source for them because they're not that easy to find.
Do you use quotes verbatim?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think
some people don't. I was like, I didn't know as a non-real journalist.
Oh, well, anyone
I was astonished
who does,
that some people think it's cool to like sort of use the verbatim.
Well, I cannot state strongly enough that that is utterly, totally unethical. It's a lie. If you put a line in quotation marks and attribute to someone something they didn't actually say, it's a lie. It's an absolute lie. If you didn't quite get all the words of the quote down, then paraphrase it. If you feel sure you know the intent of what they said, but the quote isn't, didn't get all the words down, paraphrase it. But I mean, I feel really strongly about it. It's a lie. If someone put words in my mouth, it would be like if you cut tape and piece together words or use somebody who sounded sort of like the person you were interviewing and made the tape. It's just wrong. And
we were going to do that. Is that not?
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's good. Feel free. Get somebody who has a better voice than me. But I'm outraged by the idea that it's okay. It is not okay, period. full stop. It's not. It's wrong in addition to being, I mean, it's just, it's wrong.
What's the most fun you've ever had doing an interview?
Wow. I've had so much fun. Well, it's funny because I've talked to lots of people whose names you wouldn't know who I really had fun. And I have to say that interviewing people like the Lemon Ice King, I am delighted, thrilled. You know, at the end of those experiences, I feel transported. But the most flat out fun was I profiled the designer Jean-Paul Gaultier for The New Yorker. And I was a big fan of his, which is not always my favorite way to do a story because I feel like I get complicated with my own excitement and feeling about the person. But he was such – actually, it's funny because I'm just thinking, too, about – well, anyway, I'll stick with him because now I'm thinking about other people I really had fun with. But he was so much fun, such a delight, someone who I thought – maybe we could be friends now, which is a little dangerous when you're writing a story about somebody. But as far as pure fun, it couldn't have been more fun. And hanging out with him in his atelier, watching him try clothes on models. I mean, it really was like being in an alternate universe where all the women were 6 feet tall and fabulous looking and, you know, it was just really, really, really fun. But it's a little hard for me to pick the most fun because now as I'm saying this, I'm thinking about all the other...
Who else is fun?
Yeah, I mean, just I've had some amazing experiences. I did a story about young women surfers in Hawaii where I just hung out with them for... I don't know how long it was, did sleepovers with them, ran around, basically living the life of a 15-year-old surf girl in Hawaii. And it was just a blast. And probably part of it is I am in no way a 15-year-old surf girl in Hawaii, but I could for that period of time live that life and be in that world. Which is the thing I probably love the most about my job.
So you do a podcast called Cry Babies with Sarah Thayer.
Right.
Sarah is one of the funniest people in the world.
That is true.
Like a person with so much folks might not know her name immediately, but like one of the funniest human beings in the world. Take it on faith from me.
Right.
And she comes from a world of improv comedy where one of the principles is, and I was thinking about this as you were describing wandering into a town in Oregon, is that when you're creating an improv scene, you go out there on stage and you say yes and, right, the basic principle of improv, you don't disagree with people, you don't destroy what other people have built. And you support the other people on stage. But the thing that you're looking for when you're trying to build a scene that's interesting is you're looking for that first distinctive element. Like if someone comes out on stage and says, I'm a firefighter, that's not the first distinctive element. You say, yes, I'm also a firefighter and we're having a great time at this firefighter party, right? Well, a firefighter party is kind of a distinctive element.
Right.
And maybe there is something particularly distinct and you find what it is about with a capital A, right?
Right.
And it seems to me like that is kind of the process that you are describing in wandering out to, you know, you maybe have a little, you had to convince an editor to assign it to you or whatever. So you have a little bit of a pitch, but you're looking for in these conversations, oh, what is the special thing?
Yeah, and that's a really good analogy, one that as you're saying it, I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, yes, this is improv. It's improv journalism. It is taking a notion and seeing where it leads. And some of those are dead ends, of course, but... One of the things that I think that I've been good at is even when I hit the dead end, figuring out, okay, it feels like a dead end, but some of them are really dead ends, but a lot of them, if you turn it a little, there you go. And there's the other way of approaching this. And being good at thinking on your feet is essential, because you're diving into something you don't know what you're going to encounter. Sure, if you call certain people, yes, you're there to ask specific questions. You know what it's about. But so much more of what I do is entirely, here I am, now what? And I have that feeling a lot where I think, what was I thinking? Why did I want to do this story? I don't even know. And I have to scramble. And I'm sure that must be what improv is like. You're on the stage, you're given a banana, and you're told, okay, come up with the scene. And you think fast. What? This happens to me. That is the guiding principle of the majority of my work. And certainly in the case of doing a specific profile of somebody, it's a little bit different. But much of the time, it's I have a little bit of a notion. I'm kind of curious about it. My editor says, well, if you think it's a good idea, give it a shot. And suddenly I'm, wow, what was it that got me here? I got to figure that out. And let me start flailing about and see if someone I can hook onto something that begins to make it make sense and leads to something else. As a result, I would say most of the stories that I do end up not being at all what I thought they were going to be. I take that as a good sign. I go into it thinking, well, I'm going to find out about X, and actually, if I'm really open and really listening and really paying attention, the real story emerges, the one that I couldn't have anticipated, and that's what I'm following.
What is the secret pro tip tool to interviewing that all interviewers should know that you've learned through your hard-fought experience that I haven't asked you about already?
Be a listener. Be a good listener. And sit with your discomfort, which is part of what listening requires. Those long silences, the moment where you aren't exactly sure what you're doing or a person isn't responding right away. It's not easy, but you have to learn to live with that and listen and be in the moment.
Susan Erling, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. And you are my favorite interviewer, so I'm happy to
kidding.
Talk to you about it.
You're kidding. Give me a break.
It's for real. I mean it. Thanks a lot, Jesse.
Thanks, Susan. That was Susan Orlean. Check out her podcast, Cry Baby. She does it with Sarah Thayer. She and Sarah ask people about things that make them cry. It is a hilarious, amazing show. And check out, of course, Susan's brilliant writing in her books and in the pages of The New Yorker. You've been listening to The Turnaround. If you like this show, tell a friend, subscribe, leave us a review in Apple Podcasts, share one of our interviews on social media, send somebody an email to tell them that you liked it. Send someone a handwritten note, like a perfumed handwritten note that says they should listen to this interview podcast where an interviewer interviews interviewers about interviews. Maybe they'll subscribe. That's our whole marketing budget, folks. You can always visit MaximumFun.org to listen to our shows or grab them in your favorite podcatcher. There are also text versions of our interviews on the Columbia Journalism Review's website at CJR.org. They've got edited transcripts of everything for easy sharing. CJR is a co-presenter of this show. Their mission is to encourage excellence in journalism in the service of a free society. Amazing organization. They do amazing work. You can find it all at CJR.org, including their podcast, which is called The Kicker. All of The Turnaround's music is provided to us by Mobius Van Chockstraw. You can check him out at chopsmusic.com. The creator of The Turnaround is me, Jesse Thorne. Our producers are Kara Hart and Nick Liao. Our senior producer here at Maximum Fun is Laura Swisher. Our managing director, Bikram Chatterjee. Special thanks to Kyle Pope, Emily Erskine, and Daryl Frost for making this show a reality. We'll catch you next time on The Turnaround.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.